Our scripture passage today comes from the book of James. I'll be reading chapter 3, verse 13 through 18. Who is wise and understanding among you? By his good conduct, let him show his works in the meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast and be false to the truth. This is not the wisdom that comes from above, but is earthly, unspiritual, demonic. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there will be disorder and every vile practice. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, open to reason, full of mercy and good fruits, impartial and sincere, and a harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace.
Thank you, Mackenzie. Well, this morning we are continuing our sermon series in the book of James, and as we do, we come to a section in James that's all about everyone's favorite topic and subject, and that's the topic and subject of conflict. Relational conflict, the conflict that we have with other people. And so I think we all know a little something about conflict. For some, even right now, you might be experiencing conflict in your family, maybe in your marriage, maybe with extended family members, maybe with your kids. For others, you might be experiencing conflict at work with your boss, with a coworker. For others, you might be experiencing conflict with a roommate or with a friend, or for some, you might be experiencing conflict even within this church and with a fellow church member. Or some of you, you might have experienced conflict this morning on your way to church. Raised voices, tears, all sorts of drama. So you're trying to get little Johnny and little Sally out the door to come to church here this morning. So we all know a little something about conflict, and we all know that conflict isn't always easy, especially to resolve. Like, conflict at times has different layers of complexity and is complicated. It can feel like we're at the bottom of a deep hole that's hard to figure out how to get ourselves out of. And it can be complicated, it can be messy, it can be hard to know how to resolve and get out of. And because of that, like, the last thing I want to do this morning is to try and provide you with some overly simplistic answer or trite answer when it comes to how to resolve conflict in your life. It's the last thing I want to do because I know it's not simple and I know there's not just easy answers. At the same time, I do believe that our passage of Scripture this morning is going to provide some helpful wisdom when it comes to living at peace in our relationships with others, and some helpful wisdom when it comes to living at peace and resolving conflict in our relationships with others. And so then, if you've been with us for any length of time throughout our sermon series in James, you know that James is specifically writing to Jewish Christians. And these Jewish Christians have a couple things especially that are going on in their lives. First, they're experiencing trials and suffering. In other words, if you remember, they've just recently been persecuted, displaced from their homes. They're being exploited and oppressed by rich, wealthy landowners. And because of that, like, life is hard for them. They're walking through trials in their lives. But secondly, that's not all that's going on. Secondly, they're also experiencing conflict in their relationships with one another. Not all of them, but some of them. They're quarreling. They're arguing. They're experiencing, for different reasons, just trouble in their relationships and have conflict in their relationships to one another. And so then that's why James writes this particular passage that we're going to be studying this morning, and the passages that we're going to be studying over the next couple weeks as well. He writes it to address the conflict and the quarrels that these Jewish Christians are having in their relationships with one another. And the way that he seeks to resolve and help them to resolve this conflict that they're facing with one another is to remind them in this passage of one simple truth. There's just one simple truth he wants to remind them of to help them to live at peace and to resolve the conflict that they have with one another. And that one simple truth is this. This is kind of the, you can fall asleep after this, okay? This is the whole sermon in this one simple truth. It's this. It's that if you buy into the world's wisdom, if you buy into the definition of the world when it comes to who is wise and what wisdom is, if you buy into the world's wisdom and live your life according to the world's wisdom, then you're going to experience a whole lot of chaos and disorder and conflict in your relationships with people. However, if you follow God's wisdom and live your life according to God's wisdom and what God defines as what wise is and who wise is, if you live your life according to God's wisdom, then you'll experience peace and a harvest of righteousness in your relationships with others. That's the whole sermon. That's the whole passage. Now, in saying that, I know, and James knows, that obviously conflict involves two people, right? Conflict involves two parties. And so in resolving conflict, then, it involves two people thinking like this, thinking according to the world, according to God's wisdom and not the world's wisdom. It involves both parties thinking like that. At the same time, though, this passage is going to force us to look at ourselves and evaluate our own lives and evaluate our own hearts when it comes to conflict. And it's going to show us and remind us that, and cause us to look at our hearts and to ask ourselves if one of the reasons, maybe, that we're experiencing conflict in our relationship with someone else, if one of the reasons might be that we, not the other person, just focusing on us right now, that we have bought into the world's wisdom and we're living according to the wisdom of the world rather than God's wisdom. And because of that, that's why we're experiencing conflict in our relationship, in our marriage, at our workplace, with our friends, or even within this church body. So then that's the question that this passage is going to cause us to evaluate and to ask in our lives here this morning. That within this passage, what James is going to do is it's pretty simple. He's going to contrast in this passage God's wisdom with the world's wisdom and how the world defines what's wise. And he's going to show us after he contrasts God's wisdom and the world's wisdom, he's going to show us then how each of these types of wisdom, the effect that each of these types of wisdom have on our relationships with one another and resolving conflict and living at peace in our relationships with one another. And as we see these different effects that these two different types of wisdom have on our relationships with one another, I pray that it would cause us then to pursue God's wisdom as God defines it and forsake the world's wisdom as the world defines it. And as a result, it will cause us to live in peace and harmony in our relationships that in which there currently might be conflict in. And so let's jump into this passage this morning and see this contrast then that James is going to make between godly wisdom and worldly wisdom and each of their effects on our relationships with each other. We see this contrast there, starting there in verse 13, as James, he's going to explain, and you see this on your handout, he's going to begin by explaining the mark or the distinguishing mark of God's wisdom. And we see this in verse 13 there. Look there at verse 13 with me. James begins verse 13 by asking a question. And the question he poses and the question he asks is this: who is wise and understanding among you? So these two words here, wise and understanding, throughout the Old Testament, you're going to see those two words being yoked together over and over and over again. And the reason they're yoked together is because they're pretty much interchangeable, meaning they're pretty much synonymous with one another. In other words, they pretty much mean the same thing. And so what James is asking is, who is wise among you? And so I thought it'd be fun to kind of personalize this for us, right? And think about us right now, right? Who is wise among us? Like, no names yet, okay? But who is wise among us as a church? Look around. Who would you consider to be wise here? Who would you consider to be wise among us? Well, here's the criteria in the litmus test that we're to use to answer that question. Everybody with me? Here's the criteria we're to use to determine who is wise among us here this morning. He tells us in the rest of verse 13. Look at the rest of verse 13 with me. He says, by his good conduct, let him show his works in the meekness of wisdom. So there right there, that right there, is that's the criteria that we're to use to determine who is wise among us. The criteria is this. It's that those who are wise, whoever it is among us, has good conduct and shows it by their works. Everybody with me? So that's the first evidence criteria to determine who is wise. Good conduct, good works. But if you notice there in verse 13, this wise person just doesn't do good works. They don't just have good conduct. They do their good works with a certain heart posture. They do these good works by a certain demeanor. And that heart posture and that demeanor, James says, is meekness. James says that those who are wise show their works in the meekness of wisdom. Or the meekness, the way that's constructed, is the meekness that wisdom produces. And you hear this word meekness, and you're like, okay, hear that some. What does it mean to be meek? Well, this word meekness here literally means to not be overly impressed with how important you are. To not be overly impressed with how important you are. In other words, the synonym here would be the word humility. That's probably a better translation even here. Humility. It's what wisdom produces. It's the attitude, the heart posture in which we do good works. It's humility. And humility means, you know what humility means? It means to not be concerned with how important you are. It means that you're not concerned with being prominent. You're not concerned with being significant in the eyes of others. You're not concerned about pursuing your own glory. You're not concerned about being recognized by others. You're not concerned about being esteemed by others. Instead, you're humble. And catch this, and this right here, James says, is the distinguishing mark of wisdom. It's the answer to the question, who is wise among us? Who is wise among us? It's the humble person. What that means then is this, is that you might be here this morning and be really, really smart. You might be here this morning and have a really high IQ. You might know a whole lot of things about a whole lot of things. You might even know a whole lot of the Bible. You might be able to quote a bunch of dead theologians. You might be super successful at your job. You might have a whole lot of life experience. There might be people all over this church coming up to you, and a whole lot of people at work, and a bunch of family members and everybody else coming up to you to get time with you and to ask you questions and to get wisdom from you. But guess what? Even if every single one of these things is true about you, if you aren't humble, then you aren't wise in God's economy. Instead, there might be people here this morning who can barely read, who have a really low IQ, who've never been to college, who aren't successful, who don't have an impressive job, who only might be 16, 17, 18 years old, who don't have a whole lot of life experience. But guess what? If they're humble, then they're wiser than the most intelligent person in this room. And James is saying this right here, this is the distinguishing mark of wisdom in God's economy. It's not intelligence, it's not knowledge, it's not experience, it's not your age, it's your humility, it's your heart posture. It's the distinguishing mark of wisdom and how God measures wisdom. And so then the question is who, based upon that, then again, no names. But let's ask the question again, who is wise among us? Who comes to mind? Who is humble among us? In verses 14 and 16 then, what James is going to do now is he's going to contrast God's definition of wisdom with how the world defines and measures wisdom then. And he's going to make this contrast between God's wisdom and how the world defines wisdom, and he's going to give specifically the characteristics, the origin, and the results of the world's wisdom. And we see this in verses 14 through 16 in the verses that follow verse 13. Look at verse 14 there. James begins with this word, the word but. And so the word but, as you know, indicates that James is about to contrast something. He's going to contrast wisdom as God defines it in verse 13, a life that's marked by humility, and he's going to contrast that with wisdom as the world defines it and measures it in verses 14 through 16. And here's how the world defines and measures wisdom. Look at verse 14. He says, but if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast and be false to the truth. Then he says this, this is not the wisdom that comes down from above, but it's earthly, unspiritual, and demonic. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there will be disorder in every vile practice. And so then again, do you see the contrast that James is making here? He's saying, whereas godly wisdom is marked by and characterized by good works done in humility with a humble heart posture, the wisdom of the world is characterized and marked by the complete opposite. The wisdom of the world isn't marked by and characterized by and defines wisdom by humility. It defines wisdom by selfish ambition and bitter jealousy. And think about both of those just real quick, right? First, bitter jealousy. Think about that. A coworker gets the promotion you always wanted. Someone at church is asked to serve in a certain ministry or certain ministry position that you always wanted, and you weren't. One of your friends has better behaved kids than you do. You scroll through Facebook or Instagram and you see everyone's perfect, happy, smiley life. Someone else is successful and thriving at work or successful and thriving just in their life. And you're struggling. You aren't. And for all of these reasons and a whole lot more examples, you're jealous. You're envious. Or think about selfish ambition. Again, selfish ambition is when you long to be esteemed in the eyes of others. It's the pursuit of your own glory. You desire to be somebody. You want to be somebody important. You want to be somebody significant. You want to be somebody in the eyes of others. You want to be recognized. You want to be seen and prominent in the eyes of others. And I know all of that sounds really bad and like all of that sounds like repulsive and like, oh yeah, I'm not that. Really? You sure? Like here's the dangerous thing about selfish ambition. It's subtle. It's tricky. It's really hard to detect. And because of that, then here's some questions. Just to think through, to evaluate your own heart, to see if there's any ounce of selfish ambition in your heart. If selfish ambition has begun to creep in your heart that you haven't been really able to detect, Some people, usually when we think of selfish ambition, we think of like the cornerback in football who intercepts the ball and high steps and showboats all the way to the end zone. Yeah, that person's proud. That person's pursuing his own glory. That person's all about selfish ambition. He just wants to be seen. But that's what we think about selfish ambition. We don't think about other ways it can manifest in itself in our lives. So then here are some questions to help ask and evaluate and detect if selfish ambition has begun to creep into your heart and into your life. One question to ask would be this. Are you okay with going unnoticed? Are you okay with going unrecognized and being overlooked by others, passed over in favor of someone else? Or when that happens, does that just devastate you? Does it just crush you? Or another question to ask would be, when you walk into a room like this, or any room, who are you thinking about? Really, who are you thinking about when you walk into your room? Who's on your mind? Who are you most concerned about? You? And how what everybody else thinks about you? Or when you walk into a room, are you thinking about everybody else in the room? Or what about conversations with others? What do you talk about? Or another question would be, who do you talk about? Do you just talk about yourself? Do you find yourself just trying to impress others when you talk to them? Or when you talk with others, are you more concerned about them? Are you asking questions about them? Are you interested in them more than yourself? Or a last one would be this. How do you respond when you lose? Like, how do you respond when you fail? How do you respond when you don't succeed? How do you respond when others are better than you and more successful than you at something? Like, what's that natural impulse in your heart? Does it crush you? Does it lead to self-pity? Does it drive you just to work harder to prove yourself and validate yourself? Like, this is far from an exhaustive list, but these are questions. Like, good, heart-probing questions to help discern. Is there selfish ambition in my heart? Has it begun to creep in my heart? Which then begs this question. Okay. If that's God's wisdom, humility, not pursuing our own importance and our own glory and to be recognized and esteemed in the eyes of others, that's wisdom as God defines it, as God measures it. Then on the other hand, there's selfish ambition, there's bitter jealousy. So where does that come from? Where does this sort of wisdom that says, be somebody important, pursue your own glory, be esteemed in the eyes of others, be jealous of other people's success and achievements, where does that sort of wisdom come from? What's the origin? What's the source of that sort of wisdom? Well, James tells us in the very next verse, in verse 15, look there with me. He says, this, meaning bitter jealousy and selfish ambition, this, he says, is not the wisdom that comes down from above, but it's earthly, unspiritual, and demonic. In other words, this is where this selfish ambition and bitter jealousy wisdom comes from. It doesn't come from above, meaning it doesn't come from God. Instead, it comes from three other places. And the first place he says it comes from is the world in which we live. That's what he means by this word earthly here. This type of wisdom comes from the world in which we live, the bitter jealousy and selfish ambition wisdom. Secondly, he says it comes from our flesh. That's what he means by this word unspiritual. A lot of translations translate this word unspiritual as the word natural. And that's probably more of the idea here. It's a reference to our natural physical bodies without the spirit. Or another way to say it, it's a reference to our flesh. And then finally, James says that this type of wisdom comes from Satan himself. So what he means when he says that this sort of wisdom is, did you catch that word? Is demonic. It's demonic. Like, wrap your mind around that. So, like, put all this together real quick. This is where the wisdom that says, make a name for yourself, pursue your own glory, be somebody important, seek to be recognized and esteemed by others. This is where that sort of wisdom comes from. It comes from the world in which we live. Like, this is how the world thinks all around us. It comes from your own flesh. Meaning this is how the flesh thinks. It wants glory. It wants esteem. It wants to be prominent. That's the flesh you live in. It's what it longs for. And then thirdly, it comes from Satan. Satan. Like, selfish ambition is demonic. It's demonic. Bitter jealousy is demonic. Self-worship, pursuing your own glory, seeking to be somebody important and significant in the eyes of others, it's straight from the pit of hell, and it's demonic. That's the origin of this sort of worldly wisdom and how the world measures wisdom: selfish ambition, bitter jealousy. Here's then the result of this sort of worldly, demonic, fleshly wisdom that's characterized by selfish ambition and jealousy. What's the result of this sort of wisdom? We see it in the very next verse, in verse 16. James says, for where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, now here comes the result, there will be disorder and every vile practice. Which makes sense, right? I mean, just think about our church. Like, if everyone within our church lived according to the world's wisdom and was filled with selfish ambition and bitter jealousy and pursuit of their own glory and to be esteemed and prominent and in the eyes of each other and in the eyes of the world, think about what our church would be like. People saying, I want to be the most spiritually mature person in the life of Cross Fellowship Church. I want others to see me like that. I want to be known as the best evangelist in the life of this church, the best mom, the best husband in the life of this church. That's what I want to be seen as and known as. It's what I'm striving for. I want to be up on the stage sometime helping to lead music. I want to be a DC leader someday. I want to be an elder someday. I want to be somebody important and significant in the life of this church. Or comparing yourself with one another and being jealous of one another. Oh, he gets to do that. She gets to do this. Oh, I wish I was that. You know what the result of all that is? It's disorder. It's chaos. Fighting with one another and comparing ourselves with one another and be jealous of one another. Disorder, chaos. And also every vile practice. I mean, that sort of attitude leads to all sorts of evil practices, like gossip and slander and grumbling and complaining and jealousy and lying and every other kind of vile practice and action. So then, think about the conflict that you're walking through right now, whether it's big or small, whoever it's with. Whether it be in your marriage, whether it be a family member, friendship, workplace, your workplace, school, here at church. And ask yourself this question. If the conflict you're going through is a result, the fruit of any sort of selfish ambition in your heart or bitter jealousy in your heart, I'm not saying that it automatically is, but I'm saying that it could be. Like, ask that question. Is the conflict you're going through a result of any sort of bitter jealousy going on in your heart toward the friend or spouse or coworker or family member or church member that you're experiencing conflict with? Or is the conflict you're going through a result of any sort of selfish ambition and self-worship in the pursuit of your own glory and esteem? And the reason you need to ask yourself that question is because James here says that this is where disorder comes from. This is where chaos and conflict in our relationships come from. And so evaluate your heart and see if that's where your conflict might be coming from as well. And so then these just saw the characteristics, origin, and results of living according to the world's wisdom in verses 14 through 16. Now in verses 17 through 18, James is going to contrast the world's wisdom with the characteristics, origin, and results of God's wisdom and how God measures wisdom and defines wisdom. And we see this in the very first word there that James uses in verse 17. Look there with me. In verse 17, he says, "But the wisdom from above." So again, he's making this contrast here, right? He's contrasting the wisdom from the world, the flesh, the devil, with the wisdom now that's from above. And so then this is the origin of true wisdom. This is where true wisdom comes from. It doesn't come from the world, the flesh, and the devil instead. He tells us it comes from above. In other words, it comes from God. And here are the characteristics of the wisdom that comes from above, the wisdom that comes from God and how God measures wisdom. We see the characteristics of godly wisdom in the rest of verse 17. Look there with me. James says the wisdom from above is first of all pure, meaning the wise person is pure. The word pure means morally blameless, morally innocent. Doesn't mean that they're perfect, but it does mean that you live a godly life. You seek to pursue holiness in your life, to pursue righteousness in your life. Next, then, the wisdom from above, he says, is also peaceable, meaning those who are wise live at peace in their relationships with others. Next, the wisdom from above, he says, is gentle. This word gentle literally means yielding your own rights for the sake of others. Did you catch that? Yielding your rights for the sake of others. In other words, it means you don't insist and demand your own way. It means that you don't insist and demand what's rightfully yours. Instead, you yield your rights, you defer your rights, you surrender your rights for the sake of others. Next, then, he says, those who are wise are open to reason. This word that's translated as open to reason, it literally means compliant. You're compliant. Those who are wise are compliant, meaning they're agreeable, meaning they're not a contrarian, they're not defiant, they're not always pushing back. Instead, they're compliant, they're agreeable, they're able to submit to others. Next, he says the wisdom from above is full of mercy and good fruits. In chapter 2, we saw mercy, right? We saw mercy was coming alongside to help and to care for those who are in need. So mercy is one of the good fruits that wisdom produces in a person's life. It's full. The wise person is full of mercy. Next, the wisdom from above is also impartial. Again, we saw this in chapter 2, didn't we? When James warned against showing partiality, showing favoritism based on outward appearances and based on external factors. And lastly, he says the wisdom from above is sincere, meaning it's genuine. It's not hypocritical. It's not fake. What you see is what you get. You're not pretending to be someone that you're not. And so then again, do you see the contrast here that James is making between these two types of wisdom? They're like polar opposite, right? You have the wisdom of the world that says what? Worship self. Pursue your glory. Make a name for yourself and be jealous of others who threaten your glory. The wisdom of God says, though, die to self. Deny self. Be agreeable with others. Forfeit your rights. Be merciful. Care for people. Be impartial. Be sincere. Polar opposite measures and definitions of wisdom. And here's the result then of living according to God's wisdom and God's definition of wisdom, as opposed to living according to the world's definition and measure of wisdom. We see the result in verse 18. Look there with me at verse 18. James says, and the word and here gives the logical conclusion to the virtues and the characteristics that we just saw. And, in other words, here's the logical conclusion. Here's the result of the virtues that we just saw that characterize godly wisdom. And here's the result, the conclusion. A harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. And again, this makes sense, doesn't it? If you're peaceable, if you don't insist on your own rights, but instead yield your rights for the sake of others, if you're compliant, if you're agreeable, rather than defiant and argumentative all the time, and always pushing back, if you're full of mercy and impartial, if you're sincere, like if these things characterize you and how you relate to others, then obviously you can't determine the other person's response. But if these traits characterize you and how you relate to others, then like 9 times out of 10, your relationships with others are going to be marked by peace and be filled with the harvest of righteousness, like love and care and unity and harmony, rather than discord and every vile practice like the wisdom of the world produces. And so then, again, if you're currently in a relationship of some kind that's not experiencing these things, that's not experiencing peace in a relationship right now, then you may want to go through this list and ask, is this how I'm treating the person I'm in conflict with right now? Is this my heart posture toward the person I'm in conflict with right now? I go through this list and ask, as far as it depends upon me, am I being peaceable? Am I pursuing peace and reconciliation with this person? As best as I can, am I yielding and deferring as much as I can? And not insisting and demanding on my own way and my own rights? As best as I can, without compromising truth, am I being agreeable? Am I being compliant? As best as I can. Again, without compromising truth or without compromising justice, is my heart full of mercy toward this person? Am I extending and showing mercy to this person? Again, like resolving conflict, it takes two to tango, right? It takes two to resolve conflict. You can only do your part. You can't force the other person to resolve conflict with you. You can't force the other person to live at peace with you. At the same time, you need to make sure you're doing your part. And your part involves living out these characteristics and these results that result in peace and harvest of righteousness in your relationships with those that you're in conflict with. This is the world's wisdom and what it produces in your relationships with others. This is God's wisdom, what it produces in your relationships with others. The world's wisdom is all about you. It's going to produce chaos and disorder and every vile practice. God's wisdom is all about humility and dying to self and denying self. and it leads to peace and a harvest of righteousness in your relationships with others. So, let's be honest, and we'll finish with this. This is hard. It's really hard. Relationships are messy and complex and confusing and hard and difficult and all of those things. And one of the reasons they're complex and hard and messy and difficult and all these things, because we have the world, we have our flesh, and we have the devil trying to do everything they can do to get us to live according to the world's wisdom and to cause us to live according for our own glory and to be selfish and jealous of others. And as a result of that, the world, the flesh, the devil, like, it's hard then to live out God's definition of wisdom. It's hard to be peaceable and humble and full of mercy toward others and to live at peace with others. Like, it's hard. And so then what do you do? What do you do when it's hard? What do you do when it's hard to live out God's wisdom, but it's a lot easier to live out the world? Like, what do you do? Like, how do you pursue and live according to God's definition of wisdom and not the world's definition of wisdom? Well, here's the number one way I know how. And the number one way, this isn't on your handout, but the number one way I know how is this. It's to fix your eyes on Jesus and keep looking at Jesus. And keep looking at him and 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 looking at him. And here's why. It's because Jesus never once lived his life according to the world's definition of wisdom. He never once pursued his own glory. He never once sought to be esteemed in the eyes of others. He never once was fueled by selfish ambition, like not ever once. Like, think about it, even at his birth, he wasn't born in a mighty palace like you would expect a promised king to be born. Instead, he was born in a lowly, humble feeding trough. And think about it, like in the wilderness, right, when he was tempted by Satan. Remember what Satan offered him? Satan offered him all the kingdoms of the world to rule over. Meaning Satan offered him the opportunity to be a big shot. And what did Jesus do? Jesus resisted. Jesus didn't take Satan's bait. And when Jesus came on the scene, he wasn't the promised Messiah that everyone expected. They expected a king that was going to come and live for his own glory and to be esteemed and exalted by others. But the reality is that's not why Jesus came. Jesus didn't come to pursue his own glory and make a name for himself. Jesus came to this earth to humble himself and die. It's in this way then that Jesus didn't live his life according to the world's definition of wisdom. He lived his life according to God's definition of wisdom. That's why then over and over again, all throughout the Bible, we see Jesus referred to as what? As the wisdom of God. And the reason he's referred to over and over again as the wisdom of God is because he's the perfect embodiment of God's wisdom. In other words, these eight characteristics of wisdom that James listed out in verse 17 aren't just characteristics that we're to live out in our lives and our relationship with others. These eight characteristics are a description of Jesus. Like, he's the epitome of humility. He's the Prince of Peace and ultimate peacemaker that brought about peace between us and God. He's never demanded and insisted on his own rights, but instead forfeited his rights by dying in our place on the cross. He was compliant and submitted himself to his Father's will, even if it meant that he was going to be crushed by his Father. He was full of mercy. He was impartial. He died for everyone. Doesn't matter who it is. He died for everyone who had placed their faith and trust in him, irregardless of who they are. And he's 100% completely and totally sincere and genuine. There's not one ounce of hypocrisy in him. And here's then why all of this matters. Here's why it matters that Jesus is the perfect embodiment of these traits and is the perfect embodiment of God's wisdom. It matters for two reasons. First, it matters because you and I aren't the perfect embodiment of these traits and of God's wisdom. In other words, we failed. And because we failed, we need someone to stand before God on our behalf as our perfect, righteous representative. And that's who Jesus is. Jesus is our representative who stands before God on behalf of all those who trust and place their faith in him. And so that now, as those who've placed their faith and trust in Jesus, when God looks at us, he credits us with the perfect righteousness of Jesus and the perfect wisdom of Jesus. Even though we aren't perfectly righteous and even though we aren't perfectly wise. And that's really good news. The second final reason it matters then is this. It's because Jesus didn't just embody all these different traits of God's wisdom. He embodied them for us. He embodied them for us. Like, just think about that. He's not just humble. He humbled himself for you. He didn't just make peace. He's not just peaceable. He made peace for you. He's just not compliant and agreeable. He's compliant, agreeable for you. He's just not merciful. He's merciful for you. He's just not impartial. He's impartial toward you. Like, yes, Jesus is the perfect embodiment of all these traits and of God's wisdom, but he's the perfect embodiment for you, for all those who've trusted and placed their faith in Jesus. And when you get when the reality of that then begins to like shake you, and when the reality of that begins to stir your heart, and when you begin to feel the weight and the significance and the awe and the amazement and the wonder that he's the perfect embodiment of all these things for you, then the reality then is begins to shape your heart. And realize then, as undeserving recipients of Jesus' humble, peacemaking mercy toward you, then how can you not then extend that same sort of humble humility and peace and mercy toward your relationships, particularly with that person you're in conflict with? And so then, if you're in conflict with someone else, right, it takes two to tango and two to resolve conflict. But do your part. Fix your eyes on Jesus. Keep looking at Jesus. And be stirred by the humility and the peace and the mercy that Jesus has showed you when you were in conflict with him. And let his heart toward you become your heart toward the person you're in conflict with. So that you live your life according to God's wisdom. And that as a result, peace and a harvest of righteousness would be marked in your relationships with others. Let me pray for us. Lord, thank you for your goodness and for your grace in our lives. We thank you for Jesus, who had every right to be born in the nicest, fanciest place on the planet, and to live a life in which he was the esteemed king, in which everyone and anyone exalted and glorified and lifted high, and that he was significant, important in the eyes of all the world, and he received the honor and the worship and the glory that any and every king would deserve. But the reality is he didn't come like that. Instead, he came in humility because he came as the wisdom of God. He came to die. And not just to die, but to die for us. Thank you that Jesus didn't insist on his own rights. Thank you that Jesus didn't argue with you when you told him to go to the cross and die and endure your wrath. Thank you that he didn't push back and fuss. Thank you that he was compliant and agreeable and submissive to your will. And thank you for the mercy and the impartiality that he has lavished upon us. And pray that the reality of that then would shape our hearts, humble our hearts, and cause us to live in the same way and exhibit the same attitudes of God's wisdom in our relationships toward others. As a result, that we would live in peace in our marriages, in our families, in this church, in our workplace, in our relationships with our friends and others. Ultimately, for the sake of your glory. We pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen.